stairways all the time. It's the best way of making sure the cowards don't escape. I wasn't counting on fighting revenants, though. Not after we defeated the Perished Land.
He fell silent and counted the bodies.
There's one missing, he said grimly,
a glazed glint returning to his eyes.
Unless you miscounted, scholar.
Tungdil, his mind chafing at the reasons for the orc's longevity, wasn't prepared to enter a discussion.
We'll talk at the top, he said firmly, shooing his friend up the stairs.
Boindil led the procession, and soon all the dwarves were gathered at the top of the fortified tower. From there they were able to survey the land on both sides of the gateway, including the track leading north out of Girdlegard.
No sign of the enemy, said Tungdil, relieved.
With the stone doors wide open and the bolts in pieces, there could hardly be a worse time to fight off an army of orcs, especially if they were revenants. He didn't feel ready. Girdlegard wasn't ready.
What made them keep fighting? Persisted Boindil. Was it the curse of the Perished Land?
Loud, brutish snarls heralded the arrival of the missing trooper, dragged and pushed by his smaller captors to the top of the tower.
Maybe he can tell us, said Tungdil.
This time, he didn't need to warn Boindil to keep his axes away from the prisoner. Judging by the warrior's pained expression, the message had got through.
Bring him over,
Tungdil instructed the four dwarves, who promptly pinned their victim against the battlements. It had clearly taken considerable effort to capture the orc, and the dwarves had set about their task wholeheartedly. The beast was bleeding from manifold gashes, mainly to his thighs and abdomen. His jawbone had been smashed by a dwarven hammer, and nothing remained of his tusks except two jagged stumps. Any ordinary mortal would have died of such wounds. The beast's deep-set yellow eyes darted nervously between the dwarves, taking in their bearded faces. His flat nose quivered as he sniffed the air. The rise and fall of his grease-smeared breastplate mimicked his shallow, rapid breathing.
What brought you here?
Demanded Tungdil, hefting keen fire. The diamond-encrusted blade glittered in the sunlight, dazzling the prisoner. Squealing, the orc shied away, but his back was against the parapet.
You're right to fear my axe, said Tungdil, speaking in the tongue of the orcs.
Once again, he had cause to be grateful for the cycles of study in Lot Ionan's library. The orc's terror gave way to surprise.
You speak orcish? Where are the others? What made you immortal? How strong is the Perished Land?
He swung his axe, stopping just short of the creature's nose.
Talk, or we'll kill you. It's because of the water, stammered the orc. The blood of the Perished Land turned us into...
He tailed off.
I'm not allowed to tell you.
Just then, Tungdil, who was working on the assumption that the orcs had invaded from north of the border, realized that his logic was flawed. How would an orc from the outer lands recognize Keenfire? Could news of the weapon have spread beyond Girdlegard? Would an orc be scared of an axe that he knew only from hearsay?
You know this weapon, don't you?
He challenged him.
You know the weapon, and you know who I am. You've come from the Black Saddle, haven't you?
He glared at him menacingly.
You better tell me about the water. I can't,
the orc said hastily, keeping his eyes on the blade.
Do you want me to kill you? No, but Ushnots will...
The orc broke off and looked around frantically. Tungdil read the signs correctly and jumped aside in time to evade the charging beast. But neither Tungdil nor his captive had reckoned with Ironheart's smouldering spirit. Shouting wildly, the secondling warrior threw himself on the orc, using both axes to slice through his neck. Blood gushed from the headless body, which slumped to the floor.
Bravo,
Boindil, said Tungdil sarcastically. We can safely assume that the prisoner is dead.
He tried to attack you, said Boindil meekly,
knowing that his friend was right to be cross.
Did he tell you what they were up to?
He might have done, if you hadn't cut his throat. Tungdil looked thoughtfully at the corpse. The name Ushnots seemed familiar, but he couldn't work out why.
Search the bodies, he ordered, and keep an eye out for anything that might link the revenants to the Battle of the Black Saddle.
He bent down and rummaged through the dead orc's pockets and rucksack. Boindil, full of contrition for killing the prisoner, hovered behind him.
If they came from the south, they must have sneaked past our sentries, he said evenly, fixing his gaze on the surrounding peaks.
Not necessarily. They probably got to the Grey Range before us, and lost their way in the tunnels. The signposts wouldn't be any good to them because they can't read dwarven runes. He picked up the dead beast's waste bag and turned it upside down. They weren't carrying much, which means one of two things. Either they've been traveling for orbits and finished their provisions, or they've set up camp nearby. The crazed glimmer faded from Boindil's eyes. For a short while his mood would be stable, until he was filled again with a burning desire to hunt down Teon's hordes. A cool breeze buffeted his face, drying the blood on his beard as he contemplated the ruins of the gateway.
They pulled the bolts off, he said, thinking aloud.
He noticed gouges around the upper edge of both doors. It looked as though someone had attacked them with a chisel.
Look! They were trying to take down the doors, but their second-rate tools weren't strong enough. They must have settled for ripping off the bolts.
Our smiths and masons will put everything to rights, Tungdil reassured him. He hadn't found anything yet to indicate where the orcs had come from. He searched methodically, frisking the orcs' clothing and removing his mail shirt and armor to check underneath. At last, a small chunk of wood fell out of the cuff of his glove. It was clumsily engraved with the insignia of an orcish chieftain, and it was darker and heavier than ordinary wood. Boindil leaned over to take a closer look.
It's fossilized, he said. I wouldn't be surprised if it came from a dead glade, like the one we saw in Goragar.
The memory snapped into place. Tungdil's last encounter with Ushnots' troopers had taken place in Goragar before he met the twins. While hidden in a tree, he had eavesdropped on the orcs' plan to attack the village of Goodwater. Strictly speaking, Ushnots and his band belonged to Taboribor, the orcish enclave in the southeast of Girdlegard.
Taboribor is 1,500 miles away. What would Ushnots be doing in Goragar? And why would he send a band of troopers to reconnoiter the northern pass?
He shared his thoughts with Boindil.
It stands to reason, doesn't it? Escaping across the northern pass is the perfect solution for the orcs. Ushnots lost a decisive battle, and the allied army is waiting for him to return to Taboribor. If you were a lava-livered runt, you wouldn't go home either.
I think you're right about them leaving Taboribor, said Tungdil, nodding. He joined Boindil at the weathered battlements, leaning over the parapet and running his fingers over grooves and pockmarks created by cycles of rain, wind, sun, and snow. Straightening up, he fixed his gaze on the legendary peaks of the Grey Range.
But if you ask me, they don't intend to leave Girdlegard. They're planning to settle here. What? Growled his friend. In our mountains?
He spat on the fallen orc.
May Vrakas beat your soul with a red-hot hammer and torture your spirit with burning tongs.
Thinking about it, Tungdil felt certain that Ushnots had intended to occupy the Fifthling Kingdom.
It's lucky we got here first.
He doubted that he and his warriors could have liberated the stronghold from an army of orcs. It was difficult to know what the troopers had been doing at the gateway.
Trying to close it or destroy it?
He wondered whether the orcish chieftain had been planning to charge a levy for crossing into Girdlegard. A toll system would be an excellent way of securing weaponry and supplies. Ushnot struck him as the type to exploit a situation for maximum gain. Tungdil, having made the connection between Ushnot's, the Dead Glade, and the Revenants, realized with a sinking feeling that he and the others were soon to be visited by some very unwelcome guests. How big was the Orcish army? 4,000 at least. His gaze swept the mountains, valleys, and ravines, and came to rest on the mighty summit of the Dragon's Tongue. "I promised to win back the Fifthling Kingdom for the dwarves," he murmured softly. "The Orcish invaders brought misery on Girdlegard. I don't care how many necks we have to sever. We won't let the stone gateway fall to the beasts." Boindil nodded.
"Well said, scholar. To blazes with the orcs. If they're the same lot we saw in Goregar, they'll be stronger in numbers. The odds aren't impossible, but it's a sizable challenge."
"We'll have to behead them, don't forget. Undead orcs are 4 times more difficult to kill. We lost a lot of warriors today. We won't defeat them on our own." He thought for a moment. "We can't ask the firstlings. They won't get here in time."
"What about the elves?"
"They're too busy reclaiming Alandor and destroying the Alfar. We can't rely on their help."
Boindil
stared at the sheer flanks of the great blade.
"Who can we ask?"
His eyes lit up as he thought of the perfect solution.
"The outcasts?" said Tungdil, thinking the same.
"Look!"
shouted a dwarven warrior, peering across the border to the outer lands. A milky fog had descended on the mountains, shrouding the northern pass in mist.
"There's something down there! I saw movement on the track!"
Tungdil frowned. He and his warriors were in no position to defend themselves against an army of beasts. Considering how many had been killed or injured already, they could scarcely hope to hold the gateway for longer than a peal of orcish laughter would take to echo across the pass.
"Be quiet while I listen," he commanded.
They strained their ears, listening for noises in the thickening fog. The tension showed on their faces. Boindil peered into the mist, chewing absent-mindedly on his braids. Thick tendrils of fog crept toward the gateway, slipping nervously through the opening, as if afraid that the doors would close. After listening for a while longer, Tungdil breathed out.
"You must have been mistaken," he said, relieved. "I knew I shouldn't have got my hopes up," grumbled Boindil, letting his arms hang limply by his side.
A muffled jangling sounded from below, its source obscured by the thick veil of fog. In an instant, the tension returned.
"Sounds to me like badly forged armor," said Boindil.
He turned to the 4 dwarves who had captured the orcish prisoner.
"You checked the gateway for survivors, didn't you?"
They looked at each other uncertainly.
"I think so,"
said one of them, but he didn't sound sure.
"Which is to say, we might have missed one,"
surmised Tungdil, realizing that the boulders on either side of the path were plenty big enough to hide an orc. It wasn't a reassuring thought.
"We'd better check."
"Let's catch him before he tells everyone in the outer lands that the border is open," said Boindil, jiggling his axes. "For all we know, he might be a northern trooper, not one of Ushnot's scouts."
Tungdil had no desire to fight off an invasion from the north, especially with Ushnot's marching on the kingdom from the other side. He signalled for Boindil to follow him and picked out 3 dwarves who had acquitted themselves well in the previous skirmish.
"You lot come with me, while the others keep watch."
He and his warriors hurried down the stairs. Parista, former realm of Leos Nudin, Girdlegard, Spring, 6,235th solar cycle.
"Take that, Nodon, you traitor!" boomed a heavily armored man, leaping somewhat inelegantly out of the shadows to challenge the cloaked figure in the middle of the room. His voice was muffled by a helmet which made it sound like he was speaking from inside a bucket. He struck a heroic pose. "Your cruel campaign against Gerdlakard is over. With this axe, I shall slay your inner demon and bring peace to these lands. Prepare to meet your death."
He raised a shimmering axe and swung it above his head. The blade left a trail of red light in the air, whereupon smoke filled the room. Yelping, Nodon backed away. The valiant warrior lurched after him, armor tinkling unheroically. The Magus retaliated by bombarding him with fiery sparks.
"Your dark arts can't save you," prophesied the warrior, sparks rebounding from his breastplate.
Lunging forward, he wobbled slightly before raising his weapon to deliver the final strike. Even as the axe slammed into Nodon's torso, an almighty explosion sounded from somewhere, filling the room with blinding light. When the glare finally faded, Nodon had vanished, and the warrior was stamping frantically on the smoldering remains of his cloak. It wasn't until the flames were well and truly extinguished that he turned to face the front.
"And that, worthy spectators, is how your hero, the fabulous Rodario—"
He broke off and fumbled unsuccessfully with his visor. After a time, he yanked it impatiently, and the clasp came away in his armored hand.
"Of all the confounded—"
Dropping his axe, which planted itself in the floorboards, a hair's breadth away from his foot, he raised both hands to his helmet and pulled with all his might. When that failed, he flung out his arms theatrically, causing his armor to emit an ear-splitting screech.
"As I was saying," he started again, "I, the fabulous Rodario, assisted by Andukai the Tempestuous and my loyal helpers, the dwarves, rescued Gerdlegard from Nodon's clutches and restored our kingdoms to their rightful rulers. Thank you for your indulgence, worthy spectators. Donations will be collected at the door."
He stepped forward to take a bow, stood on a wobbly floorboard, and tumbled off the makeshift stage. The orchestra pit, usually packed with musicians and technicians, was empty. His armored body clattered to the floor. The audience of two burst out laughing and hurried to help him up.
"Congratulations," said Namora dryly. "Do you think you can repeat it on the night?" "Get me out of this helmet," came Rodario's muffled voice. "I can't breathe."
Fergus, chief theatre technician at the Curiosum, examined the broken clasp.
"You've ruined the mechanism. It won't be easy."
He got to work on the visor, and a few moments later, Rodario's aristocratic features were revealed. His pointed beard had suffered terribly from his unconventional exit from the stage. In fact, his whiskers were sticking out in all directions as if to express their shock.
"Thank you,"
he said gratefully. He turned to Namora and looked at her expectantly.
"What did you think?"
"A hero must wear his armor convincingly, or the audience will boo him off the stage. You were swaying from side to side."
"Don't you know anything about tactics?" said Rodario stiffly. "A good warrior wrong-foots his opponents."
"Namora has a point."
"You need more practice," chimed in Fergus. He was dressed in tight black clothes, and his hair was specked with powder. He tried to shake it out.
"For my part, I need to work on the effects. Another flash of light like that, and our audience will be blinded. On the whole, it was good, though."
He thumped Rodario's armored back.
"Oh, one last thing. Why was Andokai's costume so skimpy?"
"Skimpy?
The estimable Mega likes to flaunt her figure.
I can't be blamed for portraying her as she is.
Of course not, said Namora sweetly. But what possessed you to cast her as your mistress?
Her smile became decidedly arch. I hope you haven't forgotten she's sending Jeroen to watch the play. You remember Jeroen, don't you? 3 paces tall, bristling with weaponry, and strong as 10 men. Oh, and he's fast as an arrow as well.
The impresario turned to Fergus.
I don't like to tell you this, he said in a wounded tone, but your wife is a heartless harridan who takes pleasure in other people's misfortunes.
Only in yours, Namora corrected him with a smile.
Anyway, you should be grateful to me. Don't say you weren't warned.
He narrowed his eyes and cast her a scornful glance.
My dear Namora, I'm using my artistic freedom. Even the estimable Mega must submit to the playwright's pen.
He turned again to Fergus.
Since your wife has no compassion, perhaps you, as a caring father-to-be, will have the goodness to free me from this metal dungeon?
He stuck his arms out tentatively and managed to lift them as far as his waist.
How can anyone fight in this get-up?
Most warriors manage to stay upright, said Fergus dryly. Wait here while I fetch my tools. You've twisted everything out of shape.
Namora went with him to the cramped workshop, where he designed and tested all kinds of incredible theatrical effects. Fergus could build props, make fireworks, cause flames to appear from nowhere, and create illusions worthy of a magus, for which he was rewarded by the audience's gasps and cheers. He gathered up a hammer, a pair of dainty pliers, a chisel, and a crowbar, while Namora examined his latest drawings.
A crane on wheels, she said admiringly.
It saves the effort of taking it to pieces and moving it by cart. We can roll it wherever it's needed, he beamed.
We're making good progress. It won't be long before Parista rises from the rubble, 100 times more splendid than before.
Namora kissed him impulsively.
Our child will grow up in a city built by its father, she said proudly. Think what you've achieved here.
I'm glad you persuaded me to work for the Mega.
He put his arms around her tenderly, taking care not to squash her belly.
If it weren't for you, I might have turned down the chance to rebuild Parista. I had another offer from Gerd Lagarde's leading actor. He wanted to reopen the Curiosum in Nymphadania, you know.
Gerd Lagarde's leading actor. Do I know him? Quipped Namora, ruffling Fergus's spiky black hair. I'm proud of what you're doing. You're too talented for the theatre.
I heard that, came an indignant shout from the stage. I heard everything. Stop delaying him, you poison-tongued witch. You'll be sorry if I expire.
Fergus laughed and stroked Namora's face. The theatre has its attractions, but the Mager pays better. He pressed his lips to hers.
Why don't you go ahead? The hero of Gerd Lagarde needs a hand with his armor.
Namora unwrapped her arms from his neck, walked to the back door and opened the latch. Turning, she watched, as he hurried out with his tools to rescue his friend. Even as she stood there, she knew that Fergus meant more to her than anything in the world. Andukai could offer her all the money and power in Gerd Lagarde, but it wouldn't match their love.
Maybe the Mager is right, and the gift of magic lies within me. But I'm happy to let it slumber.
Her gaze fell on a sheet of foolscap, half hidden by a pile of drawings. She pulled it out and gasped. It was a design for the most beautiful cradle she had ever set eyes on.
How sweet of him to hide it from me.
She slipped out quietly and closed the door. Inside, Fergus was attending to the trapped impresario. He worked a chisel between the buckled plates and pried apart the armor.
I don't believe there's a warrior in Gerd Lagarde who could damage his armor as thoroughly as you.
Rodario nodded modestly.
Excellence comes naturally.
Screeching in protest, the plates returned to their original position.
Fergus took up the pliers to straighten the hasps. I'm glad you moved the Curiosum to Parista.
What choice did I have? I needed my brilliant Fergus to dazzle the audience with his fireworks. The Curiosum depends on your jaw-dropping, purse-opening tricks.
Realizing that he had furnished his friends with grounds for a pay rise, the impresario bit his lip.
It's a shame the people of Parista aren't especially wealthy, he added hastily. A few lucky souls are on the Magus' payroll, but the rest of us make do with what we've got.
Fergus smiled to himself.
I'm sure you won't live in penury for long. You own the best theatre in the bright new city of Parista, at the heart of Gerdlegard's only enchanted realm. And the playhouse was a gift from Andukai. Don't forget.
The pliers battled with a steel fastening, forcing it into shape. Fergus finished the job with his fingers by unhooking the breastplate deftly.
There you go. Excellent work, my dear Fergus.
The impresario pulled off his helmet, shook his hands free of his gauntlets, and smoothed his tousled beard.
It was getting hot in there.
Why would anyone want to be a warrior?
Thank the gods that acting is a talent that appeals to women as well as lovers of the arts.
It didn't work on Andekai,
commented Fergus, gathering his tools and setting off for his workshop. Rodario picked up his armor and hurried after him.
Oh, cruel Fergus, he wailed. You break my heart with the mention of her name.
He flung out his right arm dramatically.
Look! There it lies, broken into a thousand pieces. How will I find the strength to make it whole again? Have you no pity?
You seem to have forgotten we're not rehearsing any more,
said the prop master, returning the hammer, chisel, and pliers to their proper places.
Leave the armor on the workbench. I'll take a look at it tomorrow.
The heartbroken Rodario forgot his sorrows and deposited the armor happily on the bench.
My dear friend, an actor must exercise his talents. My words must flow freely and effortlessly, like water in a stream.
Perhaps you'd like to divert your waterway to the tavern.
I'm sure the gentlewomen of Parista and their daughters will find it most refreshing.
Fergus extinguished all the lamps but one, locked the back door, and propelled his friend through the theatre.
Be careful about flowing too freely. We don't want hordes of husbands, fiancés, fathers and brothers banging on our door. Remember what happened in Sovereignston.
Rodario silenced him with an imperious wave.
I don't water every blossom, he said dismissively.
He turned on his heels, picked up his cloak, and tossed it over his shoulder theatrically.
But if they incline their petals prettily toward me, I'm too well-mannered to refuse.
The Curiosum was 400 or so paces from the palace, and even closer to the market. They left through the front door. Fergus padlocked the door and held out his hand.
Good night, you old charmer. Sooner or later, your little Rodario will end up on the end of a pitchfork or dangling from a flagpole. Even then, its prodigious size will put other men to shame.
Rodario winked at him roguishly.
I appreciate your concern.
He pointed to the brightly lit windows of a tavern.
How about a beverage? I'd be flattered if the architect of the new Parista would buy me a glass of wine.
His proposal was rejected.
In that case, I'll meander among the flower beds of Parista.
He raised his left hand and placed his right on his heart.
Don't worry, I'll stick to the path.
Fergus smiled and started on his usual route home. He and Namora had found an abandoned house near the marketplace, within easy reach of the many building sites under his jurisdiction. The physical labour was accomplished by those who were builders by trade. His job was to make their work as easy and efficient as he could. Andukai the Tempestuous wasn't known for her patience, and she was depending on Fergus to rebuild the city overnight. For his part, he suspected that her interest in restoring Parista had little to do with the good of its citizens. More buildings meant more people, and more people meant a greater chance of finding suitable candidates to train in the art of magic, which would spare the Magar a troublesome journey in search of apprentices. Just then, a shadowy figure leaped out of the rubble and barred his path. A dagger glinted in the darkness.
Your money or your life?
Northern Pass, Fifthling Kingdom, Girdlegard, Spring, 6235th Solar Cycle. Tungdil set off in pursuit of the orc, followed by Boindil and the trio of warriors. They were halfway down the stairs when they found themselves knee-deep in fog. Thick, clammy air swirled around their legs like fast-flowing water. Tungdil hesitated for a moment, reluctant to venture any further. "Don't be ridiculous," he told himself sternly. Everything inside him rebelled at the notion of walking through the fog, but he knew the others were looking to him for leadership. Swallowing his misgivings, he waded into the murky air. There was something about it that reminded him of the mist-like demon that had taken control of Nodon's mind. "It's only fog," he reassured himself. They left the tower and turned left, hurrying toward the border. The visibility worsened with every step. Glancing back at the others, Tungdil could tell that they shared his unease. The cold air stuck in their throats, making it difficult to breathe, and small droplets of water settled on their beards, hair, and mail. Soon their vague sense of trepidation hardened into dread.
"This is worse than a laundry,"
grumbled Boindil, breaking the silence.
"Where's the blasted orc? Anyone would think the fog was protecting him."
Just then they heard a familiar jangling.
"Did you hear that?" said Boindil, raising his axes. "We've got him."
The orc was nowhere to be seen. They pressed on, but the wearer of the armor stayed ahead of them, jangling in the distance, hidden from view. Apart from clouding their sight, the fog dulled their hearing and warped their sense of time. Tungdil couldn't say for certain how long they had been walking, and his inner compass, which worked perfectly in passageways, tunnels, and caverns, proved useless in the fog. From what he could see, it was definitely getting darker, much darker.
"Stop!"
he commanded. He heard four sets of boots behind him skidding to a halt. It was too dark to see his companions.
"Can anyone hear the orc?"
No answer. The hairs on Tungdil's neck stood on end. He raised his axe warily.
"Boindil?"
Suddenly the sound of armor was much closer. Clunk, clunk. A shadow loomed out of the mist. Its contours looked orcish. The beast lunged at Tungdil with a two-handed sword.
"At least someone can hear me," muttered Tungdil, dodging the blow.
He brought his axe down smartly as the beast stumbled past. The blade connected, and the orc howled in pain. Then the fog closed over him, concealing him from view.
"This isn't going to be fun."
Not wanting to give himself away, Tungdil kept quiet and refrained from calling to his friends. His priority was to find his bearings before the orc attacked again. He stepped carefully backward, expecting to come up against a wall of rock, but there was nothing behind him. He had wandered off the track. Clunk, clunk. This time the jangling came from the left. Alerted by the noise, Tungdil whirled round, dropped into a half-crouch, and launched himself at the orc. The blade cut into his enemy's leg, severing it at the knee. Shrieking, the orc dropped his sword and pitched forward.
"You might live forever, but you'll never grow another leg," said Tungdil, taking aim at his head.
Even as the axe chopped down, the orc rolled over and the blade hit the ground. With a scornful grunt, he crawled toward his sword. Tungdil knew he had to act quickly before noise of the scuffle drew other beasts to the scene. The orc's right hand was already closing around the hilt of his two-hander when Tungdil's axe sped toward him, cutting effortlessly through helmet and skull and embedding itself at the base of the neck. The orc slumped to the ground. Tungdil set his right boot on the stricken beast's breastplate and levered his weapon from the corpse. There was no guarantee that cleaving a skull vertically was enough to kill a revenant, so he positioned himself over the twitching body and severed the creature's head from its shoulders. Stopping to catch his breath, he leaned on his axe and listened to the silence. After a few moments, he was forced to the conclusion that, contrary to his hopes, Boindil and the others weren't somewhere in the vicinity, hidden by the fog. The orc shrieking would have drawn Boindil to him, as surely as sparkling diamonds attracts a kobold. What a sinister place. He set off and kept walking until he came to a wall. The grey rock was hard and brittle with ridges sharp enough to injure a careless dwarf. The wall hadn't been worked or polished, which confirmed his suspicion that he had left the dwarven track. The mist had led him astray. Judging by the unremitting darkness, he had wandered into a cave of gigantic proportions. Every nerve in his body was as taut as a bowstring, ready to snap at the slightest noise. The swirling mist played tricks on his mind, conjuring orcs and other phantoms in the shadows. He tried to remember what he knew of the outer lands. His old tutor, Lot Ionan, had shown little interest in discovering what lay beyond Gerdlegard's borders, and the same applied to the dwarves, who stuck to their side of the mountains. Apart from a few anecdotes told by merchants and migrants, the only descriptions of the outer lands were hundreds of cycles old, dating back to expeditions sent out by human kings. Most of the explorers had never returned, and in human folklore, the territory outside Gerdlegard's belt of mountains belonged to the souls of the dead. Tungdil, lost in the shifting fog, shuddered at the thought. If his soul had to go anywhere, he would rather it went to Vrakus's smithy. More determined than ever to get out of the cavern, he decided to follow the wall. Placing one hand lightly against the stone and gripping the axe with the other, he set off as quietly as possible. Deep down, he was terrified about what had become of Boindil and the others. After a time, his fingertips brushed against the strange set of grooves. He stopped to examine the wall. A rune! The symbol was unfamiliar to the dwarf, but there was no mistaking the craftsmanship. Elves and dwarves were known for the elegance of their script, but for all the symbol's orateness, it didn't look elvish. It could almost be dwarven, thought Tungdil, recalling the ancient stories of the undergroundlings who were reputed to inhabit the outer lands. What if they're dwarfs like us? He strained his ears. Clunk, clunk. Tungdil whirled around in surprise. I cleaved his neck. Surely he can't have survived. His confusion gave way to fear. Boindil, is that you? He whispered hopefully. Clunk, clunk. The noise was definitely getting closer. Backing away, Tungdil pressed himself against the wall, peered in both directions, and filled his nostrils with cold, damp air. The only discernible odor was the smell of wet stone. Clunk. The noise was no more than two arms' lengths away from him. He heard gravel cracking beneath a booted foot. It seemed to Tungdil that he was surrounded by orcs. He saw them towering over him, he smelled their filthy odor, and his heart beat furiously in his chest. Turning his head this way and that, he waited for the attack that would surely come. A squat shadow appeared before him. Take that, you villain! Shouted Tungdil, sprinting to the right and raising his axe. The blade connected with a steely clatter. He pulled back to take another strike, but his weapon was stuck. Careful, scholar! Snorted a voice from the fog. You could kill a dwarf with a blow like that! As Tungdil's panicked eyes refocused, he realized that Boindel was the target of his attack. The secondling had crossed his axes defensively, trapping Tungdil's weapon in a triangle of steel.
"Fracas almighty! I thought you were an orc!"
It was a relief to be reunited with at least one of his companions. "Where are the others?"
"No idea. I thought they were with you."
"Did you hear me killing the orc?"
"You killed an orc without me?"
"I chopped his head off, and then... clunk."
Tungdil gave his friend an almighty shove, and Boindel toppled backward into the fog. A split second later, an orc charged out of the darkness, his sword whistling toward the spot where the two friends had been standing. Neither was hurt. Ironheart, beard quivering, popped up behind the beast. With an ear-splitting shriek, he rammed his left axe into the creature's belly and chopped down with his right axe, hewing through its neck. The orc's torso crashed to the ground, followed by his head.
"I guess there were two of them," commented Boindel.
Sighing with satisfaction, he wiped his axes on the orc's jerkin. Viscous green blood stuck to the shabby cloth.
"Shall we look for the rest of our troop?"
Tungdil nodded, relieved. They set off together, running their hands against the wall. Their investigation revealed that the cave had three exits, one of which smelled of fresh mountain air, from which they deduced that it led to the Fifthling Kingdom. It took considerably longer to find their missing friends. Two of them were dead, mauled savagely by orcs. The third had been kept alive by the will of Vracus, but his inner furnace was cooling fast.
"There were three of them," he whispered weakly. "Three."
Boindel straightened up sharply and listened for suspicious noises in the stubbornly murky fog.
"Which way did they go?"
asked Tungdil, realizing at the same time that it was pointless to pursue the surviving orc. He was probably hurrying to join his cousins in the outer lands. A spasm ran through the dying dwarf, and the fire went out of his eyes. His soul had been gathered to Vracus's smithy.
"Let's get out of here," said Tungdil, hefting the dead warrior over his shoulder and securing him with a leather belt. "Aren't we going to find the other orc?"
objected Boindel, who firmly intended to kill the final beast. He was treated to a long look that silenced further protests. Sighing, he picked up the second of their dead companions, and between them, they carried the third. Little by little, the darkness seemed to lift, indicating that at some point they had exited the cavern, although neither remembered when. The mist retreated, revealing the starry firmament, which twinkled above them, pointing the way. Seeing the vast stone arch in the distance, they put on a final burst of speed, stopping only when they reached the gateway. Glancing behind him, Boindel gave himself a little shake as if to free himself from the sinister pull of the outer lands.
"It's a wonder any of those human explorers came back alive," he said to Tungdil. "From now on, I'm keeping south of the pass."
Tungdil agreed wholeheartedly with his friend. With the exception of the sentries who were stationed at strategic points throughout the kingdom, everyone was assembled in the main hall, where Giselbert had held council over 1,000 cycles before. At one time, the walls had been clad with silver panels inscribed with the Fifthling's laws, but orcish looters had rampaged through the hall, smashing the precious metal and pocketing the spoils. The most intricate, valuable tablets had suffered the worst. But the artistry of the Fifthlings was evident in the architecture. A double door opened onto a circular area 20 paces across, ringed by a low wall measuring a pace in height and extending 4 paces backward so as to create a circular ledge. This, in turn, was ringed by a wall which extended upward and backward to form the third tier, and so the series of ring-like platforms rose away from the central stage. The arrangement reminded Tungdil of the theatre in Mifidania, where he had first met Namora, Fergus, and Rodario. The fifthlings had even thought about acoustics, and the very faintest of whispers could be heard throughout the hall. Light came from a number of metal racks filled with burning coal. Tungdil watched from the stage as the other dwarfs took their seats above. He scanned the rows. Some 800 dwarfs, including 300 dwarf women, had left their kingdoms to form the new fifthling folk. He waited for the noise to settle.
"Thank you for coming," he welcomed them. "There are important matters to discuss."
He told them what had happened on his recent expedition, and finished by warning of a likely invasion. His listeners took the news calmly. Orcs were a constant danger, and fighting against superior numbers was nothing new.
"I led you here, but Vrakas knows I never intended to be your leader," he said, turning to the second item on the agenda. "From now on, I won't presume to make decisions on your behalf. Dangerous times lie ahead, and our enemies will be quick to exploit the slightest difference among us. We need to elect a new leader, and the matter should be settled without delay. As you know, I'm a thirdling."
He felt a lump forming in his throat.
"Recently I've come to realize that my lineage is a problem. Doubts have been expressed about my loyalty, on one occasion to my face. Until my trustworthiness has been proven to everyone's satisfaction, I shall serve the kingdom as a regular warrior and smith."
Raising Keenfire, he turned slowly to survey the tiers of delegates.
"Which of you is prepared to lead the Fifthling Kingdom? Nominate yourself or a kinsman."
He lowered his axe and stepped aside, demonstrating his willingness to make way for the new Fifthling King. The delegates conferred among themselves. Their deep voices echoed through the rock, bringing the grey range to life. Tungdil saw no reason to explain himself further. He was almost certain that some of the delegates had frowned when he mentioned his lineage, and his announcement seemed to have elicited overwhelming approval and relief. He thanked Vrakas for guiding him so wisely. A brown-haired dwarf woman rose to her feet and rapped her hammer against the stone floor. The clear tone cut through the hubbub, and a hush came over the hall.
"My name is Kiris Finehand, of the clan of the Goodsmiths, daughter of Boringar. I understand your decision, Tungdil Goldhand, but I, for one, never doubted your loyalty. The Fifthling Kingdom needs your scholarly wisdom as well as your axe."
Lowering her hammer, she inclined her head respectfully, then looked up at the delegates.
"Our new leader must be someone who enjoys our respect. I hereby nominate Glaimbar Sharpax, of the clan of the Ironbeaters, warrior of Boringar."
She listed off the firstling's accomplishments and deeds. As Tungdil listened, the hall spun around him, dizzyingly. His eyes clouded over, and a chill crept over his skin. But his inner furnace burned higher than ever, stoked by bitterness and rage.
"Make them choose someone else," he begged Vrakas, "anyone but him."
Through the fog of his thoughts, he realized that the delegates were nodding approvingly. In the short time since their arrival in the Fifthling Kingdom, Glaimbar had made a name for himself with the dwarfs from the other folks, and no one would dream of questioning his lineage.
"You fool," whispered a voice in his ear. "You've ruined your chances. If you were king, you could post him to the furthest reaches of the Grey Range, or send him to fight a band of orcs. But now, you'll have to do the deed yourself.
Just be sure to do it quietly. Push him over a precipice, crush him with a falling boulder, splice his skull with an orcish weapon, chase him into the Outer Lands." Tungdil summoned all his strength and focused on Boindil's face. The fiendish voice grew fainter, fading gradually out of earshot, but the hatred remained in his heart, and the sight of the handsome firstling made him tremble with rage. For the first time he understood Boindil's urge to hack someone, or something, to pieces, and he pitied his friend. His grim thoughts were interrupted when he realized that Kyrus had stopped speaking. She and the other delegates were looking at him expectantly.
"Our first nominee is Glaimbar Sharpax of the clan of the Iron Beaters of Boringar's line," he announced with a catch in his voice. "Let the next candidate step forward."
No one stirred.
"Are none of you willing to serve your folk?" he asked, venting his bitterness.
He tried to look at his rival, but his gaze was drawn to Belindis, who was standing at his side.
"In that case, we have one contender, Glaimbar Sharpax, of the clan of the Iron Beaters, warrior of Boringar. Do you accept the nomination?"
During what followed, Glaimbar rising and answering with a solemn yes, the delegates clapping and cheering as he walked to the stage, the axes rising in his favour, Tungdil's thoughts were elsewhere, focused on his beautiful, unobtainable smith. At last, when the delegates went down on one knee and raised their hammers, axes and clubs to the new fifthling king, he tore his eyes away from Belindis.
"The fifthlings have elected Glaimbar Sharpax as their king," he said, scanning the rows of faces and refusing to acknowledge the dwarf at his side. "May he rule with the wisdom of Vrakus."
He left the stage without a bow or a handshake. He wasn't prepared to humble himself in front of his rival, not as long as he lived. Once out of the hall, he decided to walk off his anger. He started through the passageways, striding past scaffolding and building sites where the secondling masons had started to repair the ceilings and walls. His feet carried him to the outer reaches of the kingdom, where he came to rest among the ruins of an orcish watchtower. Overcome with emotion, he stood among the rubble and looked up at the stars. Tears of anger and despair streamed down his cheeks, trickling through his beard and dripping onto his mail shirt.
"You should have known better than that, scholar. Your armor will rust."
Tungdil smiled in spite of himself.
"I suppose you're here to drag me to the banquet."
"Vrakus himself couldn't drag you there, so it's hardly a job for a simple dwarf like me."
Boindil glanced up at the twinkling stars.
"What do you see in them, scholar?"
"I guess they're pretty after a fashion, but I'd rather look at glittering diamonds in freshly hewn rock. Won't you come inside? We need to work on our plan. The king has given his approval."
"Oh, really? You didn't waste time?" Tungdil turned to his friend. "If we leave right away, we might run into more of Ushnot's scouts. Is that what you're hoping?"
Boindil ran his hands over his stubbly cheeks and smoothed his beard.
"Am I that transparent?" he said with a smile. "Listen, I'm not in the mood for singing either. Let's have our own celebration with Boendal and tell him about the plan. You never know. It might just be what he needs to unfreeze his blood and get him going."
They set off through the passageways, taking the route that led to the forge, where Boendal was lying on his camp bed by the dragonfire furnace. Tungdil sat at the frozen dwarf's bedside and talked to him as if he could hear every word. Their hopes that Boendal would make a miraculous recovery were disappointed that night. Perista, former realm of Lias Nudin, Girdlegard, spring 6235th solar cycle. The highwayman's features were hidden beneath a mask, but Fergus recognized the voice immediately. He put his hands on his hips and confronted his assailant.
"Don't be an idiot, Rodario. If the guardsmen see you..." "Your purse," said the highwayman harshly, waving his dagger. "And make it snappy."
"What? No flowery speeches."
Fergus stepped toward him.
"Put away the dagger before someone sees us. We don't want anyone rushing to my aid."
The highwayman stood his ground and ran his finger menacingly along the blade. Fergus was assailed by doubt. In view of his prospective fatherhood, it seemed best to be careful. He unhooked his purse from his belt and threw it to the ground.
"That's more like it,"
growled the stranger, stooping as if to retrieve the loot. All of a sudden, he threw up his arms, pulled the mask from his face, and roared with laughter.
"You fell for it," crowed a jubilant Rodario. "How do you rate my performance now?" "I could tell it was you," said Fergus, picking up his purse. "What's got into you?"
"Consider it payback," said Rodario smugly.
He paused for a moment to draw out his victory. "I heard the two of you slandering my reputation while I languished in my armored prison. Given the choice, I would have ambushed Namora, but..."
"It's a good thing you didn't," exclaimed Fergus. "The Curiosum would have to look for a new leading man."
He took the dagger from the impresario's hand and tapped his forehead.
"For someone who's quite clever, you're amazingly stupid."
"Your money or your life," said a voice from the rubble. "And make it snappy."
Fergus rounded on his friend.
"Don't tell me there's more."
The impresario was white as a sheet.
"Mine was a one-act play. I'm afraid he must be real."
They turned around slowly to face a masked assailant holding a knife. The weapon glinted as it sped toward them. Skipping aside, Fergus plunged Rodario's dagger into the highwayman's arm. The blade slid into the handle, re-emerging when the stranger stepped away. He and Fergus stared at the dagger in confusion.
"It's a prop," explained Rodario. "I'd never draw a real weapon on a friend."
With a scornful laugh, the highwayman bore down on Fergus, slashing at him with the knife, which seemed to be coated with a strange yellow fluid. The prop master retreated, ducking and spinning away from the poisoned blade.
"I'm coming, Fergus," shouted his friend, arming himself with a plank.
Just then a second man stepped out of the rubble, raised a cudgel, and brought it down on Rodario's head.
"How unsporting,"
mumbled the impresario, drifting out of consciousness.
"Are you Fergus?" demanded his attacker.
The voice echoed through Rodario's dazed mind. He opened his eyes. A sword dripping with yellow fluid was pointed at his chest.
"Over here!"
shouted the first man.
"Fergus is over here!"
"If you're looking for Fergus," whispered Rodario feebly, "I'm your..."
Despite his wooziness, he made a grab for the highwayman, but his fingers closed on thin air. The maneuver earned him a kick to the head, and darkness came over his mind. Meanwhile, Fergus had been forced against the wall by the smaller of the men.
"What do you want?"
"Your money,"
hissed the highwayman. His companion ran over to join them.
"Hand it over."
Fergus unhooked his purse for a second time that evening and cast it to the ground.
"There you go. It's all I've got."
The first man picked it up and weighed it in his hand.
"Good. In that case, we're done."
He was about to say something further when a shadow fell over them. Looking up, they saw the dark outline of Jeroen's armor silhouetted against the moonlit sky. The Magus' bodyguard was crouching on a raised portion of wall, in his left hand a sword 2 paces long. A purple glow emanated from the polished visor. Then the light intensified, and Jeroen let out a terrible growl.
"Palandiel forfend!"
stuttered the smaller highwayman, transfixed by the monstrous warrior. He took a few steps backward, unable to look away.
"He'll tear us to..."
Jeroen launched himself from the wall and soared through the air. Just then the second highwayman came at the astonished Fergus with his sword. The blade rammed into his stomach, passing through his guts. A second later, the highwayman fell to the gutter as Jeroen, bringing down his sword, landed beside him and cut him lengthways in half. The sword continued in a sweeping arc, lifting perpendicular to the floor as Jeroen whirled around and struck the other highwayman from behind. The blade caught the man above the pelvis, penetrated his unarmored midriff, and exited the other side, coming to rest in a wall. Legs attached to his upper